To order. It's 1:36, the 27th of April, 2007. We're back from recess, and we're going to continue hearings on working on the bill, Senate Bill 104, the Alaska Gasline Inducement Act. With us today is Mr. John Norman, Chairman of the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, if he could come forward. He's going to talk about the gas takeoff study and give us an update on other issues that he feels are pertinent to AGEA. We will then have questions, and that will pretty much conclude today's work. And then we'll, at the end of that, we'll talk about tomorrow. Tomorrow will be a bit, will be a busy day. But Mr. Norman, if you could introduce yourself for the record and tell us who you represent. And
thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Norman. I'm the chair of the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. We're officed at 333 West 7th Avenue, Anchorage, Alaska. My two co-commissioners are Commissioner Dan Seamount, the geology commissioner, and Commissioner Kathy Forrester, the engineering commissioner. The AOGCC, by way of quick introduction, is one of the oldest regulatory agencies in the state of Alaska. Our basic mission is to regulate the exploration and production of oil and gas within the state for the following purposes: prevent waste, protect correlative rights, which is a way of saying make sure that all of the owners of a resource have their fair chance to recover their portion of it, work to ensure greater ultimate recovery of Alaska's valuable hydrocarbon resources, and protect underground sources of fresh water. The AOGCC exists as an independent quasi-judicial regulatory commission, and I have on the topic before you today prepared some materials which I believe are being passed out. One is a general summary of what I will say for the record. Additionally, there is a copy of the non-confidential portion of the February 28th report that we concluded on Prudhoe Bay gas offtake rates. And then there are some papers in there that will help with an understanding of the trade-offs between production of oil versus gas in the different reservoirs, one directed toward Prudhoe Bay, a second specifically directed toward Point Thompson, and a third to the North Slope generally. Mr. Chairman, most knowledgeable Alaskans understand the significance of 35 trillion cubic feet of natural gas. That number has been bandied about along with other numbers, but very few people have an understanding that hundreds of millions of barrels of oil and condensate could be lost if gas offtake from the North Slope reservoirs is not properly managed. Oil is Alaska's bird in the hand, gas is our bird in the bush. The AOGCC is responsible for setting gas offtake allowables from North Slope fields to ensure that we don't harm our bird in the hand as we are pursuing and aspiring to grasp our bird in the bush. In general, maintaining reservoir pressure enhances oil recovery, but producing gas depletes reservoir pressure. Just thinking of it simply as any container or a soft drink, that gas in there represents reservoir energy. In most fields, gas is generally sold only after all of the oil has been produced, or at least as much as can be recovered. Until then, gas that is produced with oil is generally used to promote increased liquid production in various ways. For example, gas can be re-injected into the reservoir to provide energy to get the liquid hydrocarbons to the surface, to lift the oil to the surface, in other words, or it can be used for other enhanced recovery techniques including as a miscible injectant. All of this is happening right now at Prudhoe Bay and at other fields on the North Slope. Therefore, major gas sales for the North Slope is going to involve trade-offs between oil and gas recovery. It's never practical to think in terms of getting every drop of oil out of the ground before starting gas sales, and the AOGCC certainly doesn't take this position. We do, however, want to ensure that the trade-offs that inevitably will occur result in greater ultimate recovery of both oil and gas, in other words, total hydrocarbon recovery. Prudhoe Bay already has an existing gas offtake allowable. That allowable is set and has remained set for many years at 2.7 billion cubic feet per day. Normally, the AOGCC waits for an application from an operator to update, modify, or even set pool rules. However, in 2005, and even beginning before then, it was recognized that there were serious discussions taking place concerning major gas sales from the North Slope. To position ourselves to be able to do our part that we might be called upon to do at such time as sales began, the Commission also considered other things, that our existing rate was set at 2.7 BCF, that rate is now almost 30 years old, that at the time it was a good rate based upon all then available information, but since that date, we now have 30 years and 11 million barrels of production from Prudhoe Bay, and that information can be used to help fine-tune and determine a more efficient optimum production rate. We recognize that most publicity concerning the different options of gas offtake and sales from Prudhoe Bay contemplate that possibly more than 2.7 billion cubic feet per day may be required. We also recognize that performing the necessary studies to determine an appropriate offtake rate would take time. And finally, going back a couple of years ago, the AOGCC did not want to be the cause of any delay in any project. So that said, at that time, we began to build on some of our earlier studies to try to position ourselves so that we could be ready to move fairly quickly at such time as a major gas sale was determined to be firm and definitely in the offing. At this point, I want to emphasize the normal process would be to receive an application from some owner or the operator asking us to take some action. And it was a concern to us that we had received no application. And in fact, even to date, we've received no application from any owner. So again, I would like to make that point and ask you to keep that in mind, because normally the triggering event for an agency such as ours that acts in a quasi-judicial fashion, holds a public hearing, takes testimony, is to act upon an application placed before us, not to go out and search for things that we should be acting on ahead of the owners.
If we could just stop there for a minute, is that something we should be concerned about, or is there lots of time to do that type of work between now and when we need to have gas for a gas line?
It was a concern to me as chair of the commission and the other commissioners, and that's what prompted us to begin on our own initiative to undertake the studies that we have done. And I can address that. The answer will be somewhat, there'll be one answer for Prudhoe Bay and another for Point Thompson right now. Yeah. The short answer, Mr. Chairman, is that with reference to Prudhoe Bay, we feel with the work we've done, we're well positioned now to be able to move very quickly and be in a position to do proper rulemaking on a Prudhoe Bay gas offtake rate to update our rate. I'll address the situation at Point Thompson more fully in the course of my testimony.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I've got a question.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As you look at the commission, it has to do more with the makeup of the commission, and we're dealing with multi-year, even multi-generational concerns that are out there, and billions of dollars. Do you think that that's too big a job for the number of commissioners that you have, and that the commission should be increased so that we can better regulate what's going on out there?
No, Senator Olson, that's a very good question, and it's one we have thought of. In order to be able to discharge our responsibilities, I believe, and that was something I was asked to think about when I first went to the commission, I believe the current makeup is good. The staff is excellent. We work through the issues. The one thing that is a drain on resources isn't the subject we're talking about now, but it's the things that go wrong, the enforcement actions, the investigations, and that sometimes pulls our geologists and engineers away. But right now, I would represent to you that we believe that the current makeup of the commission is adequate to the job.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thanks.
Mr. Chairman, in order to allow us to proceed with our study and to gain the most current information, we have worked with BP and other Prudhoe Bay working interest owners, and we reached an agreement with them whereby they would provide to us access to their simulators, including underlying engineering, geologic, and geophysical information. They voluntarily set up a data room in BP's Anchorage offices, equipped with computers and software allowing review of simulator results. It's important that I note here that the information, a large part of it provided to us, was done under confidentiality statutes, specifically AS 3105035D and 20 AAC 25.537B. The terms of those confidentiality agreements, however, contemplate that when the Commission moves into formal rulemaking, then we absolutely must have the ability to place into the public domain, the public record, sufficient information to support whatever we do. That's a given, and that's an understood. In simple terms, right now, however, the information that's been voluntarily provided to us was something that we would not otherwise be entitled to. It belonged solely to the Prudhoe Bay working interest owners. At the time we undertook this, beginning in 2005 and then getting heavily underway in 2006, that information was proprietary, belonging solely to the Prudhoe Bay or working interest owners. And the only way to get to it would have been to do what we did, and that would be to agree to keep it confidential. I would like to acknowledge that we are very satisfied with the level of cooperation we received from BP and the other working interest owners on allowing us to carry out our statutory responsibilities with reference to positioning ourselves to be able to set a current gas offtake rate. This past February, February 28th to be specific, we published a report at a public meeting. We heard comments. The portions of the report that we are able to make public at this time are available on the AOGCC's website, and I have provided a confidential summary, and if you can give me a moment, I can direct you. It's at page 8 of the handout information that you have. Understandably, when we in February announced the completion of our initial phase, at least, of the Prudhoe Bay offtake study, we received a number of questions about what's the number. I'm going to now try to explain why it is not possible to give a specific number right now, other than to reconfirm that our existing offtake rate remains set at 2.7 BCF, and that we are prepared, upon receipt of an application by an operator, to move very quickly to be able to update that. Setting an offtake rate is a multivariable equation. The right offtake volume will depend upon when sales start, how aggressively the oil has been produced in the meantime, and I'll return to that in a moment, what mitigating steps are in place and are planned. And secondly, of course, we have, until we begin formal rulemaking, the legal restrictions on making public the confidential and proprietary information shared with us by the operators. As soon as we receive an application, or if we otherwise have enough information to cause us to think that we should begin a formal process to make a meaningful determination, we will then publish a notice, convene public hearings, and then make as much information available as we can, consistent with the operator's right to have certain information continue to remain confidential and proprietary. We intend to complete our evaluation, hold hearings, and make our final offtake rates by setting allowables for both Prudhoe Bay and Point Thompson well in time for any open season. At this point, what I can say are a few general principles that should be kept in mind. And I mentioned before the trade-off between oil versus gas. The later gas sales begin, the smaller the oil losses will be. That's a simple statement, but important. Depending on the life of the North Slope infrastructure, if major gas sale offtake is delayed too long, this could result in decreased overall hydrocarbon offtake. The lower the offtake rate, the smaller will be the losses. The more that oil production right now, and I'm speaking with reference to Prudhoe Bay, the more that oil production can be accelerated. In other words, right now today, oil's flowing through that pipeline, and the more that can be accelerated, the more that can be continued, and the more the operators can either voluntarily or be caused to avoid interruptions of that flow, the less there is a conservation concern. Acceleration, therefore, is an important issue, and we intend to work with the operator and continue to study what can be done while others are working toward getting major gas sales up and running to accelerate production. Additionally, mitigating steps will be important. Right now, there is injection of water into the gas cap, which when I first heard it, went counter to everything that I had ever learned in the oil industry, but there was a pilot project and that is working. That's the type of a measure by forcing water into that gas cap. It's a method of filling that voidage and helping to maintain reservoir pressure. Another thing we're looking at, just as an example, is the injection of CO2. When the gas is produced up there, a percentage of it is CO2. And that CO2 can be continually recycled, and that would be a mitigating measure that would allow oil, let me say it this way, our desire and intention is to try to maintain as much continued oil production as possible while at the same time allowing gas sales to ramp up. We are confident that unless a substantial delay occurs, and the effect of a delay would be to make our current study stale, because these studies have a shelf life. And so I think it might be a fair question, why didn't you do this 10 or 15 or 20 years ago? But we're studying a dynamic reservoir. So where we are right now, we have a study that we're well positioned, and that'll be good for the next 2 to 3 years. And if things get delayed much out beyond that again, then we're going to have to again revisit this, which can be done, but I do want to make that clear. For the moment, I think in leaving Prudhoe Bay, I would say that the AOGCC right now is positioned to move fairly quickly. The triggering event normally that would occur, and it would be our preference, would be that the owner or operator come in and submit an application to us and say, this is our desired offtake amount. And then application would be supported by information that would be worked through. A public notice would be issued. We would take public testimony. We would test a number of the assumptions, but we do have a very good running start on that. I want to talk now, shift to Point Thompson, if that's agreeable, and leave Prudhoe Bay. Everything I've said up to this point generally applies to our study with Prudhoe Bay in cooperation with BP as the operator. A year ago, the AOGCC and Exxon and its partners agreed upon a similar process for studying the allowable gas offtake from the Point Thompson Reservoir. The AOGCC contracted with a reservoir evaluation consultant to assist and work with the AOGCC's own technical staff performing the Point Thompson study. Exxon and its partners agreed to give the AOGCC staff and consultants access to a data room in Exxon's Houston offices. It was agreed that the data room would include reservoir engineering, geologic, and simulation information, and would be equipped with computers and software allowing review of the simulator results. The study was supposed to begin before September 2006 and was anticipated to run for about 180 days. Exxon and its partners indicated that they had planned then later to apply to the commission late in 2006 or early 2007 for offtake rules at Point Thompson. Unfortunately, we are behind on that timeline. Exxon had delays in preparing the data room and information, and the process was finally slated to begin late last year, but this was at about the same time that the Department of Natural Resources found Exxon and its partners to be in default on their leases. They found some deficiencies with the Point Thompson unit, and then there were some further determinations with the leases. So I don't want anything I say here to be interpreted as the AOGCC making a pronouncement one way or the other on a matter that's now in the Superior Court concerning the validity of those leases. But in any event, this caused a halt to this cooperative effort that we were about to embark on. Since then, that study has been on hold pending resolution of legal issues without the ability to work cooperatively with the owner that has many, many years of experience with that reservoir and the complex proprietary models. It will be very difficult in a timely manner right now to be able to set a responsible offtake rate or even approach how that reservoir should be developed. So Point Thompson right now, as we see it, is a bit of a wild card. In summary, Mr. Chairman, at both Point Thompson and Prudhoe Bay, there are hundreds of millions of barrels of oil that are at risk if it's not approached properly. And I use the old analogy of the bird in the hand versus the one or two in the bush, but it is important as we properly talk and focus on gas sales that we not lose sight of the fact that we do have a bird in the hand there in that oil, and we do not want to approach allowing that oil to be developed in a way that might result in waste. The AOGCC is charged with setting a gas offtake allowable that protects Alaska's valuable hydrocarbon resources. The AOGCC intends to perform its function so that it will not delay the project, and our intention is to have this done before open season, subject to the qualifications and the issues that I've identified for you. We've done as much work as we can right now in a technical way to prepare us to address Prudhoe Bay's offtake rate without causing any delay. I have to tell you, the lot does still remain to be done at Point Thompson, and it is possible that some delay could result there. And I thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'd be happy to take any questions, and our Petroleum Engineering Commissioner, Kathy Forrester, is also on the line, so that if there were technical questions, she is more qualified than I to respond to those.
If we just go back to Prudhoe Bay before we come forward to Point Thompson, how much time do you need, or will it take, for the AOGCC to be done with its analysis and ready for its recommendations to facilitate the gas line?
If we received an application today, I think is one way of phrasing your question to me. If someone were to present an application to us today, then I believe that probably within 180 days we could move forward, and that would include doing our technical review, some freshening up, updating, going through the legal process that we're required to follow, which is to publish the public notice. There are some individuals that you all are easily as well of, and companies and Alaskans, that have strong feelings on what ought to happen with the gas, and they have an opportunity and a right to be heard in a public forum. So, but given all of that, were we to receive that application, we would begin to work on it. We would publish a notice. We would set a date for a public hearing. We would take public testimony. If there were still remaining questions, we might request some additional briefing. But I would say that 6 months, one way or the other, with some give or take, would be the time frame at Prudhoe Bay.
So that doesn't appear to be problematic for us moving forward? So I'm a little confused. Earlier I thought you had mentioned that you were concerned because, you know, there hasn't been a request, but...
Well, yes, and so that's why I prefaced my response, Mr. Chairman, the way I did, that if we were to receive an application today, now someone would file an application with us. So that would be the triggering event. If we don't get a request, then we're somewhat shooting in the dark, because we would have to have someone come in and ask us. This is the way it normally works. The AOGCC, I think if we go back to 3105, it would help frame it. As a quasi-judicial agency, we in some ways behave similar to the way a court behaves, in that we don't go out and simply start dictating the pace of development. Operators come to us and indicate to us, this is our request, this is our desire, and then we will either approve it or deny it or approve it with some amendments. That's the ordinary process. If there are other parts of our statutory authority that state that if the AOGCC finds that waste is imminent, in other words, someone is about to proceed in a manner that would commit waste, then on our own initiative, we conduct hearings, we initiate inquiries, but those are the normal triggering events.
So one of the things we're concerned here about is having a successful binding open season sooner than later.
Yes,
so what dates, if they have, if hypothetically you have 36 months to open season, then we should see your commission kicked into gear at what time frame?
Well, at a minimum, the operators or the owners or some other party withstanding should be prepared to come to the AOGCC and file an application at a minimum 6 months ahead of that, and that's at a minimum. I mean, obviously we would like a little more time, but they need to come in. And the reason for that, as I mentioned, are, first of all, we would need to know, first of all, what is the desired offtake rate to make a project work? What are you asking for? And we would try to work with that rather than trying to guess at it. What is your anticipated startup offtake date? And then we would, the two most important things, though, are what can you do right now in the interim, because offtake is necessarily going to be years in the future. So what can you do right now to accelerate production to remove this trade-off between oil and gas? Is there anything more that you could be doing? And what mitigation measures do you plan to employ to make sure that in producing gas, you don't waste oil? The public process is the forum in which we have that give and take. We ordinarily do not engage in a study as we're doing now, and I think properly we don't, because we must necessarily, we regulate the industry, and consequently, if someone comes in and presents an application, we have something tangible and specific to act on. We don't have that as yet from either Prudhoe Bay or Point Thompson.
And then, just a second, on Point Thompson, give us a time frame on that.
On Point Thompson, if we could get underway.
Would you like me to give that a stab?
Okay, I hear Kathy on the line, and Kathy is our lead commissioner, and Mr. Chairman, if it's all right, Kathy has put a fair amount of thought into this and can probably give you a more precise timeline than I can.
Yeah, Kathy Forster, if you could identify yourself for the record and who you represent.
I will. My name is Kathy Forster, and I'm the Engineering Commissioner for the Oil and Gas Conservation Commission.
And then could you give us a time frame on the Commission's work to facilitate opening up Point Thompson?
From the point in time at which we were to achieve access to sufficient Point Thompson information owned by the Point Thompson owners, from the time that that access began, it would take a minimum of 1 year to complete a technical analysis, at which point we would kick in that next six-month phase. So at least 18 months, possibly longer.
Okay, thank you. Senator Elton and Senator Huggins.
Two questions.
And Senator Dyson.
And hopefully they're fairly simple. The first, I'm referring back now to page 4 of your testimony, Chair Norman. And there are 6 points that are made about what you feel comfortable saying. I'm remembering testimony from last year, which suggested, and I think we heard it from several different people, which suggested that at this point in time, every well that is drilled that hits only gas is like a dry hole, because there's no way of getting the gas to markets. So with that as the predicate, I mean, is it too simple to say there should be a point number 7, and that point saying that the sooner we get a gas pipeline, the more oil we may produce and get into the oil pipeline? And I recognize that the first 6 points are all measurable. There are scientific ways of doing it, and my point number 7 might not be. But is it too simplistic to say if we get people drilling more because there's access to a gas pipeline, we will get more oil in the oil pipeline?
Yes, and thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do understand the question. The question, it's kind of like going bird hunting. Often the more hunters you have out there that are staggering up birds, why, then you get more in the air as opposed to one person. So if you had the ability to market both gas and oil, then that might stimulate more oil. I mean, that argument is certainly there. We recognize it. There are other considerations such as the time value of money, things like that. But I'm speaking primarily to the focus of our commission, and our objective is to, with all of that being considered, nevertheless, to try to make sure that in the process we don't waste what we already have. That's our main function. If I could follow up on that, it might help to understand now. At Prudhoe Bay, there are still to be recovered approximately 2 billion barrels of oil. Right now, that is a huge reservoir. There was a report in the press last December about a huge discovery in the Gulf of Mexico, and that was the Thunder Horse field. That was a 1 billion barrel field. So right now, Prudhoe Bay represents, within the United States, if you found Prudhoe Bay today, forgetting the 11 billion that's already been produced, you would just have stumbled on the sixth largest oil field that's ever been found in the United States. So there is a lot of oil there, and it is very important that attention not be fully diverted to in a rush to get gas going so that we ignore that. At the commission, we believe that that we can try to do it so it's not either or. In other words, we're working in a way to try to see what acceleration can be brought to play, as well as what mitigating measures and other steps, so that we recover as much oil as we can, and at the same time we allow gas sales to proceed when the operators are ready. But I mean, your point is a valid one.
Okay, and Mr. Chair, a second question, and this has to do with your testimony on page 5 and the recent news reports. I'm curious. You note that AOGCC has contracted for reservoir evaluation consultants. And so I'm presuming, A, that you've spent money. I'm presuming that somebody has tried to determine what recourse the commission has on recovering some of that money if, in fact, because Exxon has changed its mind, you can't do the work. And then the third part is, is this entirely Exxon's decision, or is it a decision that can also be affected by the opinions of the other people who have interest in the field?
Well, first of all, no, we haven't at this point considered any sort of recourse or recovery. The amounts I have looked at, there, I believe, and I could provide these to the committee, but I think we have spent a couple hundred thousand dollars on that aspect of it. I'd have to check on that, and I could give you an exact amount. What we are doing, I have written a letter to Exxon, and I have asked them for their position, and it's my understanding, and I would, again, with your permission, Mr. Chairman, ask Commissioner Forrester, because she's been in more recent direct contact with Exxon, but I believe they are considering this. It would be our desire to continue this informational exchange with Exxon while whatever happens with reference to the leases in the unit, the legal issues play out. We see them as distinct, and so I'm hopeful right now, we're not turning our attention to trying to make a claim against Exxon. We're turning our attention toward continuing to allow the commission to gain as much information as we can about this unique reservoir. And I'm optimistic that we'll be able to do that. Kat,
Mrs. Forrester, how?
I think you put that very well, John. Before we damage our relationship with Exxon, we need to work to get them to come to a decision, because just in the last 4 months, it's been yes, we're on, no, we're off, yes, we're on, no, we're off. And so we've put it in writing. We've asked them formally to make a decision and either say no, we're off, or schedule a meeting and let the work begin. And so let's give Exxon a little time to make a formal decision and either put it in writing that they've stopped or start the process. And then if they put it in writing that they've stopped, then we can look at other avenues. But it's, if we're going to proceed to understand the technical data that is owned by them and the other owners, it's in our best interest to maintain as good a relationship with them through that process as possible.
If I could follow up.
Second. Ms. Forrester, the chair will call on you when we want you to speak.
Just a follow-up question, and I may have missed it in the answer. Is the decision solely Exxon's, or is it a decision that has to be concurred in by the other participants?
Is that for me?
Yes.
Through their working interest ownership and their operating agreements, they have to have a certain majority vote, and I think that at least two, probably three of them have to agree to any decisions that they make. But again, you'd have to look at their operating agreement. But I would guess that BP, Exxon, and Chevron and Conoco, maybe all four of them have to agree to something because they're the primary owners.
Ms. Forrester, that's an area that seems to be a little confusing from time to time. We get testimony from both ends of the scale saying that it's an independent decision, and then sometimes we get testimony saying it's not an independent decision. And could you clarify?
I apologize for that. When typically in our agency speak, we refer to the operator as the entity, but often decisions require other owners' agreement. And typically what will happen is all will have to agree or it doesn't happen. So in formulating an agreement to share the data from the Prudhoe Bay owners, if one of the major owners had said no, then it could not have happened. And that's typically the way things go in these sorts of agreements. And it's the same in their agreements to spend money. If Exxon wanted to drill a well at Point Thompson and the other owners didn't agree, then it might not happen.
Okay.
But when we talk about who's drilling the well at Point Thompson, we don't say Exxon, BP, Chevron, and Conoco. We say Exxon. But typically when we refer to the operator, we're referring to him as the representative of all the working interest owners. So I apologize for that misunderstanding.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Norman, you have a comment?
Well, I was just going to say, Mr. Chairman, I agree with what Kathy said, and the answer, to the extent the unit agreement and unit operating agreement are still in effect, would lie within the four corners of that operating agreement. And very typically, it calls for certain percentages of approval for certain things to occur. So I don't think we could give you that answer now. It is my understanding that operating agreement is on file with the state of Alaska, and it should spell out what percentages of ownership. Now, the situation is complicated somewhat because occasionally there are additional restrictions on release of proprietary information, sometimes requiring unanimity, and then it's also complicated. I don't need to tell you right now because of the entire question of of whether there even is any longer a Point Thompson unit agreement, or a unit, so to speak, is right now a legal issue. But I believe if a starting point would be to go to that unit operating agreement, and that generally spells out the things that an operator can do of its own volition or without the consent of the others, and the things that require the consent of the other operating partners.
I heard today that it's 14 boxes. Okay. Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. On page 5, and looking at the reference to a data room, and let's assume two scenarios. One, you have access to the data room and the information. One, you don't. You're doing it unilaterally. What's the difference in the time frame to come to your conclusion, and what's the cost difference?
Senator Huggins, if I'm understanding the question, Mr. Chairman, it is if the AOGCC performed its own study without access to this data. We did look at that because we were not at all sure that we would get the cooperation initially. So we did look at that, and we concluded that in terms of both dollars and cents and time, it would be significant. The reason being that the operators have lived with these reservoirs for years in a fairly intimate way. With people assigned full-time to work on them under the AOGCC's general oversight, but it would take us a substantial effort to, in both terms of dollars and cents and time. I think right now if you would want us to pursue that, I would prefer to reflect on it and provide a letter about what that might have been, as opposed to just giving you something off the top of my head. But it would have been the cost in the millions of dollars, many millions of dollars, for a study like this if we had to embark on it on our own independently. It also would have had the potential for a great deal of conflict, because on some of it, the only way we could get it would be to pry it out of the operators. We do have subpoena power. And then that raises all sorts of legal issues, and then it translates into time. The one thing I am comfortable with right now is that the way we have gone at Prudhoe Bay has worked out according to our expectations, and I think it's important to make clear that we have cross-checked and double-checked everything as the representatives of the administration, the legislature, the city, people of the state of Alaska. It's not a matter of accepting what they have, but it greatly facilitated our ability to do this by having that base, all of that information available and access to these models that we otherwise would have had to build. We could have possibly then gone down a few rabbit trails on our own before we, and a lot of questions, and again, that would have taken time. So at Prudhoe Bay, it has saved time. At Point Thompson, it remains to be seen how those events play out.
Okay. Follow-up, Senator Huggins?
If I might then, but assuming you have the information, the data room, how long does that evaluation take, and is cooperative?
Commissioner Forrester is our lead on that. The other two commissioners have purposely not participated in that proceeding for legal reasons, because we will receive most of that information in a public setting and according to the Public Meetings Act. So I want to add that qualification. Mr. Chair, with your permission, I'd like to ask first if Commissioner Forrester might be allowed to respond to that question.
Ms. Forrester, if you could respond, please.
Yes, I would. Mr. Huggins, through the chair, what we experienced at Prudhoe Bay was approximately 1 year from the time we got access to the data to the time that we had a completed report. It was just, we got access in January of 2006, and we published our report in February of 2007. And I would say that it would take at least that long at Point Thompson, because at Point Thompson, in addition to the types of questions that we would have to address, that we had to address at Prudhoe, there are also geological and geophysical questions of great complexity that must be addressed before we can even start to do the things we did at Prudhoe Bay. So it would be at least that long, and possibly longer, maybe 18 months.
Okay, thank you.
Just to do the study.
Would you have a follow-up, Senator?
Yeah, if I might, for either John or Kathy, whomever's appropriate, based on the chair. Operator agreements. Someone here in the last month alluded to that the state is maybe as much as a couple years behind on the information on what's contained in operator agreements, whether we have a couple-year-old version, or there are interim versions that we never received. Could you just kind of bring us up to date in about 45 seconds or less on that subject?
Yeah, the commissioner will answer that question.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Senator Huggins through the chair. The operating agreement is a companion agreement with the unit agreement, as you know. The unit agreement describes some physical boundaries and some leases that will be committed to a unit, and the whole idea is to allow a general area to be developed in an orderly fashion as opposed to a bunch of individual operations going on in a more uncoordinated way. The logic behind that is that the reservoir boundary deep beneath the earth doesn't respect the section lines and townships, and so the idea is to try to create a unit that as much as possible encompasses this subsurface reservoir and then approach it by development in the most orderly way, with each owner recovering its own share. So you enter into the unit agreement, and that's hammered out and negotiated, and then you turn to phase two, and you have ordinarily a number of partners, and in this case, for example, at Prudhoe Bay, major partners would be ConocoPhillips, BP, Exxon. Somebody is designated operator then, somebody like an operating partner for any business, and then in the operating agreement, it will address a number of things. All sorts of items are included in an operating agreement. Everything that you would expect there, such as what if the operator resigns, how do you replace an operator, what authority does an operator have to make expenditures attached to an operating agreement, is a COPUS, an accounting schedule, setting forth how accounting will occur. The operator normally gets to charge the others a certain amount of overhead, if you will, for operations, and then plus expenditures. As wells are drilled, an operating agreement commonly requires notification, and then the other operators have an option whether to participate or not in a well, depending on the type of the unit. If they don't participate, then they can later back in after the other owners who have taken the risk get a penalty. All those sorts of things are there, and that's in the first operating agreement. My experience has been in working with a lot of operating agreements over many years is gradually then you'll get amendments, you have companies that exit, you'll have new companies that come in, and you begin to get these layers of first amended, 10th amended operating agreement, and sometimes it can be a fairly difficult chore to begin to work back through all of those layers. So I'm not familiar with right now the specific that prompted your question, but that's a general experience that occurs in many operating agreements.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Dyson.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. I have, I think, five questions, all for Kathy.
Okay.
Kathy,
Yes, sir.
What's the volume of gas that at Prudhoe that's used for fuel gas for injection?
It's about right now, I want to say, half a BCF. So if we were to take off 2.7 BCF, I think the expectation would be that two of that 2.7 would be available for sale, and the other half to three quarters of a BCF would be used for fuel.
Yeah,
using our current 2.7 offtake allowable.
As usual, you're ahead of me. With the EOR techniques and water flood and so on that have been introduced since you guys decided, or the commission decided, that 2.7 BCF maximum offtake rate, you got a sense of which when you all reevaluate what direction the optimum offtake rate will go, and just a rough guess of the delta?
Senator Dyson through the chair, I apologize for what will sound like a mealy-mouthed answer, but no, I don't, because what that offtake will be is going to depend on primarily how much of the oil has been gotten out beforehand, and secondarily, what mitigating steps they have in place to to use other things besides the gas, like water injection into the gas cap and using CO2 for the EOR. But if they've done an aggressive job of in-field development drilling, and if they haven't had substantial shutdowns to slow things down and go in the opposite direction of accelerating the production, and if they have a good plan in place for replacing that gas with something else, then my expectation is that the offtake will go up, that the allowable offtake will be greater than the 2.7 that we have now. But again, it's going to depend on all those variables. So, you know, I know people get mad at us when we say we can't give you a number, but yesterday Commissioner Norman put it in terms of, if there were a request to you guys to say what the budget for the state of Alaska was going to be in 2009, you couldn't tell us, because there are a lot of things that are going to happen between now and then that are going to impact that number. And that's kind of where we are with this. There's a lot of stuff that's going to tell us what that number is that we don't know.
Yeah, but you told me what I wanted to know.
Okay, I thank you for your patience.
Okay, next question, please. Go ahead.
Are there areas there where wells are shut in because of the GOR ratios gone gunny sack?
Through the chair, yes, sir. There are lots of shut-in wells, and there are also what's called cycle wells. You know, there are wells that have a low GOR that are constantly producing. There are wells that have such a high GOR that they've been shut in for a number of years, and there are other wells that are what's called cycle wells. Their GORs are high, but if you leave them shut in for a while, then the GOR drops a little bit, and then they bring those wells back on for a week, a month. It varies from well to well, and then the GOR climbs again, and they have to shut them back in. So there's a whole variety of wells like that with different kinds of GORs.
Are they? Is there a pattern to those, and do they tend to operate in certain parts of the field, the high GOR wells?
You're about to exceed the limits of my current Prudhoe knowledge. But
okay.
Again, further off in the oil rim, there's probably lower GOR, and closer into the gas cap areas of the field would be the higher GOR wells, just in general.
Okay. Senator
Do we
Johnson.
Have wells that are, excuse me, do we have wells that I think it's called channeling, it's actually the reservoir is a bit damaged from high pressure gas blowing through to the wellbore?
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, I don't know the answer to that question.
All right.
But I will get it for you.
What would you expect on an average across the field as a percent of CO2 in the gas?
Through the chair, I would say that it's about 10%, maybe 11.
All right. And last question. In a traditional or in a field like this one, what's kind of the optimum way of handling the gas liquids? Realizing, I understand we don't have the infrastructure to get them to market at this point.
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, in a situation like the North Slope, where there is this huge field with 2 billion barrels left in it, and there are other fields that can increase their ultimate recovery by enhanced oil recovery operations, the typical thing to do with these liquids is it's kind of a balance. You put some of them into the pipeline, but the rest of them have a market. I call it a market, but have a use. And that use is to be reinjected with gas to make a miscible injectant that increases the oil recovery from the oil part of the reservoir simply by I don't hate to say scraping, but releasing some of that oil that wouldn't otherwise flow out, making it more movable and getting it to the wellbores. And not only do they do that at Prudhoe Bay, but they send some of their miscible injectant to other fields across the North Slope. So those liquids have a use.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you.
Senator Elton, you look like you had a question a bit ago.
I've got a new question, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Kind of back to my old question, and I'm just sitting here kind of mulling. I'm back on page I'm five again in the Point Thompson conundrum. And I guess, I mean, you had mentioned that so far we've got sunken costs of a couple $100,000 in the reservoir evaluation. If you can't answer now, maybe you can get back to the committee or somebody can get back to the committee. I'd like to know what the nature is of the contract that you have with the reservoir consultants, evaluation consultants. I mean, I'm assuming that that we have a contract with them and we're obligated to pay them. And that leads to the next component of the question. What is the nature of the agreement that you had with the leaseholders or the leaseholder at Point Thompson? Was it an informal, vocal agreement that you had with them, or was that a contract that you had with them to perform the evaluation of the reservoir? And third, you had mentioned that you're working, or maybe Kathy had mentioned that you're working, trying to work out and come to an amicable agreement with Exxon. I guess I'm curious if that's an open-ended process, or if at some point you say, you know, we've given you 3 months to try to work this out, and we're tired of paying our consultants, and we need to figure out how we're going to deal with the issue.
Mr. Norman, it's...
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sir Jalton, through the chair, our contract is with a very well-known international engineering firm that has expertise on this particular type of reservoir, Gaffney Klein. It generally is on a fee-for-service basis, so it isn't like we have a taxi cab parking out there with the meter running. We do have a certain amount of an investment in them now, but we are trying to use that as efficiently as possible, and I will get you a number in the next few days as soon as we can retrieve it as to what we have spent on studying Point Thompson thus far. As to the agreement with the leaseholders, it is a formal agreement. It is reflected in an order of the commission called a statement of principles. It pretty much mirrors what moved ahead before was the similar agreement we worked out with the Prudhoe Bay owners. There are not, to my knowledge, any real substantive differences, although there were some negotiating points that with the Point Thompson lease holders, they wanted a few things that were slightly different. When we talk about an agreement, it is reflected in an order of the commission saying we agree to proceed in this fashion, and the commission will execute a confidentiality agreement that's attached to that statement of principles. I believe those to be public documents. I would like to check again on that. And if my assumption is correct on that, then we'd be happy to provide those documents to you so that you can see what the arrangements are. But it's not a loose arrangement. It's a very tight arrangement. It's not a contract. I'll finish with this statement. The commission had two pathways we could have gone as along the line Senator Huggins asked. One of them was to embark upon this study and to try to use our subpoena powers and to try to force information to be forthcoming, or the operators could cooperate with us. We did present that choice first to the Prudhoe Bay operators, and then once that was underway and off running, similarly to the Point Thompson operators, and that resulted in formal orders adopted by the commission after public notice, after opportunity to comment. There were a number of comments by other parties outside this. The agreements were made available to the public for review. And so unless there is some impediment, I will see that the committee, Mr. Chairman, receives a copy of our statement of principles governing the studies for both the Prudhoe Bay and the Point Thompson reservoirs.
If you can get your answers back to my office, and we'll get dispersed out. And you follow up?
Yeah, well, just to make sure that you understand the full nature of what I get. I mean, I guess
we could read the agreement that you have with the leaseholder, but I'm perfectly willing to accept an analysis and a shortened version by somebody from the commission that just says whether or not one party can abrogate the agreement. That's what I'm trying to get to. And then secondly, maybe some kind of suggestion, and it doesn't even need to be a public suggestion, I guess, but getting back to the committee and letting us know how long this attempt to amicably resolve the issue goes before other processes are tried, I guess.
We have a May 16th deadline, so when we get into some of these agreements, we don't have time if in fact they're 14 boxes thick.
I understand, Mr. Chairman, and I will get a specific answer to you concerning abrogation of it. But I believe that they are terminable. And then if we don't get the level of cooperation we expected, our position then is to fall back on the legal tools that we have to proceed in formal rulemaking. I do have one of the agreements right here now applicable to Prudhoe Bay, and I'll just need to check it and see line by line to make sure it's pretty much the same. But I'll try to give you as specific an answer as I can.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Senator Thomas, you had a question.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On both pages 3 and 4, I believe, you indicate that a mitigating factor for the offtake or the time frame for the offtake and how much would be how aggressively the producers approach their oil production. In your estimation or in your mind, are they doing that at this point in time in the Prudhoe field? Is there a lot of activity there pointed in that particular direction? Number of rigs, drilling new wells to access the oil and those injection rigs, things like that, is that being done?
Through the chair, Senator Thomas, yes, it is with this qualification. The thing that has been disappointing to the commission and disappointing to all Alaskans are some of the interruptions of production, which is a slightly different way of talking about acceleration. Acceleration is one thing, but if you stop production or shut in a field for a month or two, and then you put it back on production, hopefully, eventually, you recover that oil. That's one thing the commission looked at to see if there would be any damage. But when you recover it, it's at the tail end years later. And by that time, the trade-off becomes more acute between oil and gas, because hopefully by that time we are close to having a pipeline and major gas offtake. So the thing that we, like all of us, want to see is attention given to the aging infrastructure there, attention given to maintenance, attention given to a lot of the things that could cause an interruption in production. For all the reasons everyone else does, but from the commission standpoint, when that production stops and then it resumes, certainly you're recovering again the same volume, but what you could have recovered is now thrown out years into the future. But I think I would conclude that that is something that would be scrutinized when an application is presented to us. Right now, we believe that the operators are doing all they can to recover oil, and certainly it's in their financial interest to do so. Certainly the Division of Oil and Gas oversees that also, because that rings the cash register for the state of Alaska. But the commission keeps an eye on that likewise. But specifically, we will, when an application is presented to us, then pose them the questions about what more could you be doing to accelerate production, and what more could you be doing to avoid interruptions of production.
And just one
follow-up, Mr. Trump.
Sure, one here. Would you anticipate that after dealing with some of these, more current and different situations that we're dealing with as trying to get into the gas production, that leases might be written differently to allow information that might not necessarily be considered proprietary, but is simply reservoir information that helps you do your particular job rather than relying on it being given to you voluntarily or having to subpoena it, you know, something in regulations that would help you in the long run.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Thomas, no, I don't think necessarily the key to getting us what we need is through the leases. And the reason I say that is our jurisdiction runs statewide. So it might help to think about it, production off, for example, ASRC lands, native lands. The state, the native's 44 million acres, or Cook Inlet lands, or federal lands, or in the NPRA. We're still very much interested in managing that. The commission, specifically according to the authority conferred on the commission by this legislative body, exercises the police power of the state of Alaska. So we don't wear the proprietary management hat. We exercise the police power, and if we believe waste is occurring, we're blind to whether it's on state land or mental health trust land or native-owned land or federal land. The state of Alaska still has an interest in making sure that doesn't occur. And so I think the tools that we have, we do right now have the tools to get the information that we need. The pathway of a cooperative effort, in our opinion, got us there faster. And this was a complication that has arisen as to Point Thompson, but if we need to fall back on stronger methods, we have subpoena power, we have the ability to convene hearings if waste is imminent, and we have the methods that we could employ to get at this information, although sometimes that's a more complicated way to do it.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, seeing no further questions, I'd like to thank Mr. Norman for coming forward today and for Kathy Forrester for being online. Tomorrow, 9 a.m., we're going to start with Senate Bill 125. We'll bring that back with the CS. We probably will not take action on it tomorrow because I want time for the members to be able to look over the CS. And hopefully we'll bring it back Monday and take some action on it. Tomorrow, after Senate Bill 125, which hopefully won't take too long, half hour or so, we're going to have testimony from British Petroleum, followed by TransCanada, and then the Alaska Gasline Port Authority. So it will be a long day tomorrow. We will take a recess break for lunch and probably a few stand-up breaks along the day because it's going to be a long time or quite some time to get all three of those done. With that, we'll see everybody bright and early at 9 a.m. Meeting adjourned.